But it does seem like there are all sorts of, they're missteps. They're blind alleys. They're extensions. Seems as though God really didn't have much of a purpose. You think, for example, back in the Cambrian period, the trilobites ruled the world for 100 million years. Now, these animals were apparently the greatest animal in existence at the time, and you would think that if there was a purpose involved in this, that they would survive, but they didn't. They died out. As far as we know, they've been gone for a long time. Seems as though they didn't work out. And sometimes later, you get dinosaurs back in the Mesozoic era, beginning about 200 million years ago. And we have about 100 million years when the great dinosaurs rule the world. And surely these great animals would be tremendous in size and power and so on. And yet somehow they didn't work out either. They died out. Seems so, tries the trilobites, they don't work. The dinosaurs, they don't work. Then it's so God finally just accidentally hits on man. And now he's trying man for a while. It's like maybe he won't work out either. And it just seems as though the Creator doesn't really know what he's doing. He goes in this direction and that direction. What's the purpose? Why would dinosaurs rule the world for 100 million years, die out 100 million years before man ever appeared on the scene, if man is to be the ultimate goal of the evolutionary process, as the theists presumably would believe, either man or something higher than man later on, maybe? It seems as though there's no purpose to it, and furthermore, not only no purpose, it's the most wasteful process and cruel process that you can just about conceive of. Think of all the multiplied billions of animals that suffered and died in the course of the evolutionary process. For no reason, if man is the goal of all this, if the purpose was man, why didn't the Creator just create man? He could do that. What's the purpose of all this waste and cruelty for billions of years? It seems to me, I sometimes tell young people if they feel like they've got to believe in evolution because science requires it, okay, you make that choice. But don't blame God for it. He wouldn't do a thing like that. He's more wise, more powerful, more gracious, more loving than to institute a process like that, seems to me. So it seems like if one is going to be a theist and believe in a God of purpose and love at all, he would have to reject evolution. God wouldn't do it like that. Well, all right, let's go on to one who doesn't profess to believe in God, but he does believe in good. I call him a humanist, an altruistic humanist. He believes in man as the ultimate good, perhaps. And he does believe in trying to improve people and improve society and improve the lot of the exploited and so on. He's an altruistic humanist. It seems to me like if one is really that, if he really believes in the good of society and of the world and of mankind, he would have to reject evolution. Because you see, the evolutionary philosophy has been made the basis, either rightly or wrongly, it certainly has been made the basis of all the systems that have degraded and exploited mankind from time immemorial. Nowadays, the dominant philosophies which are competing in the world are communism. And, of course, communism, everyone knows, is based squarely on evolution. Some communists are Darwinians, others are Lamarckians, but at least they're all evolutionists. Understand, I didn't say that every evolutionist is a communist. People think I say that. I didn't say that at all, but I do say that every communist is an evolutionist. He has to be, because his whole system is based on it. Karl Marx, in fact, wanted to dedicate Das Kapital to Darwin. He wrote Darwin, asked him if he could do it. Darwin said no, his wife wouldn't understand. But at least he didn't argue with the thought involved. Not only communism, and of course everyone, not only Marx, but Lenin and Stalin and the present-day communists, all are thoroughgoing evolutionists. They have to be. The whole system is based on atheism. And on, of course, Marx wrote to Darwin and Engels also, said that Darwin had given them in science the evidence which they needed to support their ideas of social and economic evolution. And so they felt they owed a great debt of gratitude. I could document this, but I won't stop to do that. Of course, Nazism may not be so important anymore, but in my lifetime it certainly was. We went through World War II and the times before that. In those days, Hitler and Mussolini and their whole system looked like might dominate the world and certainly had a tremendous amount of followers. Well, did you know that that system was based squarely on evolution? Hitler and Mussolini were ardent Darwinians. Let me quote from Arthur Keith. Arthur Keith was the great British anthropologist who was in on the Piltdown discovery and so on. He wrote a book called Evolution and Ethics, which is most revealing. Arthur Keith was a strong evolutionist, and he lived during World War II and the bombing of Britain by Germany, and he didn't enjoy that at all, of course, and he was continually being torn between his commitment to evolution, which justified it, and his commitment to England and his patriotism, which rejected it. But after the war, he wrote the book called Evolution and Ethics, and listen to what he says. He says, "Let me say the conclusion I've come to is this. The law of Christ is incompatible with the law of evolution. The two laws are at war with each other. The law of Christ can never prevail till the law of evolution is destroyed." Then he says, "To see evolutionary measures and tribal morality being applied rigorously to the affairs of a great modern nation, we must turn to Germany in 1942. We see Hitler devoutly convinced that evolution produces the only real basis for a national policy." And then with his idea of the super race and so on, he justified all of his actions on the basis that he was a good scientific evolutionist. Not only communism and Nazism, you could go on and on. I'll just mention one other, and that's racism. Did you know that racism is based on evolution? Back in the 19th century, all the 19th century evolutionists were racist on a scientific basis. Here's what Thomas Huxley said. Thomas Huxley was a great Darwinian protagonist back in the 19th century. This is in a book called Lay Sermons. Thomas Huxley, of course, was an agnostic, but he preached a lot what he called lay sermons. And this was during the time right after the Civil War here in America, and he was referring to that. He said, "No rational man, cognizant of the facts, believes that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior of the white man. And if this be true, it is simply incredible that when all his disabilities are removed and our prognathous relative has a fair field and no favor as well as no oppressor, he will be able to compete successfully with his bigger brain and smaller jawed rival in a contest which is to be carried on by thoughts and not by bites." Now, that's Thomas Huxley. Now, if anybody said that today, why, he'd be branded the worst sort of a racist, of course, and he would be. But this was common in the 19th century by the evolutionists. Darwin said essentially the same thing. He thought that the white race had advanced further in the evolutionary line than the other races and was going to wipe the others out in the struggle for existence. And every one of the 19th century evolutionists thought the same thing. Now, sometimes people have the notion that racism comes out of the Bible. Well, no such thing. The Bible doesn't mention race at all. The concept of race isn't in the Bible. Some Bible students have misinterpreted certain verses of the Bible, but the Bible itself doesn't teach that there is such a thing as a race. I don't even like to use the word because I don't think there is such a thing as a race. A race is an evolutionary category. It's a subspecies in the process of evolving into new species. The Bible talks about nations and languages and so on, but not about races. There's only one race, that's the human race. Only one kind of man, that's mankind. Now, the idea that there are races stems from the thought that over long periods of time, a small population gets isolated and gradually evolves in one direction, another in another direction, and they have a long period of segregation and mutation. Natural selection gradually develops a different race over here than over here. And naturally, if they're long segregated and independently evolving, why, one may evolve more than the other. That's why the modern scientific racists, men like, say, Shockley and others, Kuhn, they're really good evolutionists, and they're very strong, ardent evolutionists, because they believe that evolutionary science supports it. The Bible doesn't support it, but the idea of racism really comes ultimately from evolutionary studies. You don't find it anywhere else. And so on. As I say, all of these systems, not only atheism and communism and Nazism and racism, but also old behaviorism and even such things as the imperialism, the military imperialism of the 19th century, that was based on Darwinism, social Darwinism in this country, the dog-eat-dog capitalism, all of this was based on Darwinism. Anything which pits one group against another group and struggle to gain the ascendancy, whatever it is, whether it's race, class, nation, or whatever, is based on evolution. And this sort of thing, which does not elevate society, but rather harms it, based on evolution. So that's what I say. If a person is really a real humanist and really wants to do good for society, it looks like he ought to reject evolution. Well, we've just about gone over the spectrum. That's six of them, if you've been keeping count. One other one. Here's a man who says, well, I don't believe in anything except what I can see and measure. I'm the scientist. I just believe in what I can see, what I can measure. I don't have faith in anything, Bible, God, anything. I just believe in what I see and can measure and prove scientifically. He's the scientific pragmatist. Well, if anybody ought to reject evolution, it ought to be the scientist. Because science, if science is what you see, nobody ever sees evolution take place. Who's ever seen one kind evolve into a different kind of animal? Nobody's ever seen anything like that anywhere. Oh, you see horizontal changes. The peppered moth changes from light color to dark color. Now that they clear up the atmosphere over there, it's changing back to the light color again. The fruit flies develop mutations. The insects, population shifts toward those that are resistant to DDT and so on. Still the same insect, still the same moth, still the same fly. Significant that 1,000 successive generations of accelerated evolutionary pressure on the fruit fly. All kinds of mutations have been produced on that poor little animal with the radiations and everything. But after 1,000, maybe 1,500 successive generations of accelerated evolutionary pressure and all kinds of mutations being produced, fruit fly is still a fruit fly. Isn't beginning to be a house fly or a horse fly or a mosquito. Still the same thing. Nobody has ever seen evolution from one kind into a higher kind. If science is what you see, nobody ever sees evolution. All we see are horizontal changes within limits. That's exactly what the Bible teaches happens. That's what the creation model predicts would happen. And that's what happens as far as anybody ever sees. Nobody ever sees a transitional series in the fossil record either. And as far as the laws of science are concerned, the very basic laws of science, first and second laws of thermodynamics, the most certain, best proved laws of science that there are, the nearest approximation to the laws of science that there are, as far as we can see, no exception ever found to either one of them. The first law says that nothing is now being created. That's exactly what the Bible said. God rested from all of his works which he created. Nothing is being destroyed. It's also what the Bible said. He is now upholding all things by the word of his power. And the second law says that everything is going downhill towards decay, and that's also what the Bible says. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. Everything is going down to the dust and the bondage of decay. So these two basic laws of science say that the universal processes of nature operate within the framework of conservation and disintegration. Evolution says that there must be universal principles of innovation and integration, exactly opposite. Nobody ever sees that. If science is what we see, why, a scientist ought to reject evolution because there's not the slightest scientific proof for evolution. Everything that we see in the real world fits the biblical record of creation. Well, now I've gone over the spectrum, I guess, fairly completely, and every group along the way, everything seems to reject the concept of evolution. Then a good question is, well, then how come so many people believe in evolution? If nobody ought to believe in it, then why do so many people believe in it? Well, it seems to me that there are two types of people who believe in evolution. One type of evolutionist, is the one who is trying to find the means of explaining things without God. He wants to have some escape from God. He wants to explain the world and to avoid any possible accounting of with the Creator. So he, by every means possible, he tries to explain things without God. Now, that's the type of evolutionist who is really the leader of evolutionary thought. Men like Huxley, Simpson, Dobzhansky, Meyer, Muller, the other men who have written most of the books and so on, these men, really, evolution is their God, natural selection. In fact, Julian Huxley said, it's irrational even to believe in God because natural selection can account for any known form of life. We can forget about any supernatural intervention by God in the evolutionary process. To him, evolution is God. Natural selection is God. Well, now, most evolutionists are not like that. The leaders of evolutionary thought, for the most part, are. But for the most people who are evolutionists are not leaders, they're followers. And it's the followers of evolution that tend to be the theistic evolutionists, not the leaders. And I think for the most part, these people, that is the second type of evolutionist, is the type that I used to be. That is one who's an evolutionist just because, well, put it this way, the reason most people believe in evolution is because most people believe in evolution. We're conformists. If everybody believes it, the textbook says it, the teacher says it, must be true, so I'll have to believe it. We'd never really have studied it much, don't know much about it, but everybody believes it, so it must be true. We're conformists. We don't want to go against the stream. And I think really that's the reason why most people are evolutionists. At least that's the reason why I was. But now, that's not a very good reason. After all, that just simply means either of two things. Either you're too lazy to study and find out the facts, or you're afraid to face the facts. And neither is a very good reason. Now, first, certainly not for a Christian, and I assume that most of this group here tonight, suppose are Christians. For a Christian, we're commanded to study to show ourselves approved unto God. Don't be lazy. Furthermore, we're commanded, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 19 says, Timothy, but you could put your own name in there, 20th century young Christian, you guard that which has been committed to your trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. The word science is the word for knowledge, if we get our word Gnostic or agnostic, but refers to the philosophy which was dominant in Paul's day, which is the same as the philosophy in our day, that is the evolutionary philosophy. Every system, except biblical creationism, has been an evolutionary system from the beginning till now. There were different types of evolution. Modern type may be a little more sophisticated than some of the others, but the Stoic philosophers and the Epicureans and the Gnostics and the Platonics and the Neoplatonics and all of the others were evolutionists. And these were the ones who were dominant in the Apostle Paul's day. And by that I mean that they believed in very old universe and gradual changes, the forces of nature personified by different gods and goddesses, finally organizing themselves into more and more complex systems. They were all evolutionary systems. The only place you find special creation is in the Bible. Sometimes I hear people say, well, Moses wrote about special creation because the people of his day couldn't understand such a sophisticated concept as evolution. Well, that's nonsense. All they'd ever heard was evolution. Long, long ages and slow changes and gradual development and so on. The concept of special recent creation out of nothing but the power of an omnipotent personal God was a radical new concept that the people of Israel had never encountered before. Because they'd been among the Egyptians and the Canaanites and the others, the Babylonians, they were all evolutionists. You read the Babylonian cosmogony and see or the Chinese cosmogony or the Canaanite, all of these were evolutionary systems. Well, anyway, that's beside the... get back to the admonition to the Christian to guard that which has been committed to your trust and to avoid these oppositions of a false so-called science. Evolution is not real science. It's propagated in the name of science, but it isn't real science because it can't be tested scientifically. And also we're exhorted, 1 Peter 3:15 says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and with fear. That's a command also to the Christian. Be ready always to give an answer, and you can't be ready unless you know the answer, and you can't know it unless you learn it, which means you got to do some study. And this is the answer that people need because people have been indoctrinated in this system that leads away from God for generation after generation. I was, and you've been, and we're to give the answer. And by the way, the word answer is the word from which we get our English word apologetics, apologia. A systematic, careful, scientific defense of the Christian faith is what it means. And then you compare that, too, with Romans 1:20. And then you compare that, too, with Romans 1:20. I'm going to quit in just a minute, but I keep thinking of these things. Romans 1:20 says, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. In other words, that tells us that in nature, in the structure and processes of nature, in the creation, there's a clear testimony to the fact of God and the power of God and the nature of God, the Godhead of God. It's all there. If we had time, we could show how the processes of nature point to the fact of God, and the structure of nature points to the nature of God. That is the triune nature of God, the Godhead. It's all there. So that they are without excuse. People, particularly scientists who deal with these things all the time, are completely without excuse if they don't see God. And the word excuse is the same as answer, apologetic. Paul says the unbeliever, the skeptic, does not have an apologetic. He believes, that's why I said earlier, he believes in spite of the evidence. He has a credulous faith. He has no apologetic. But we have an apologetic. Be ready to give an apologetic. We have it. We have a reasonable faith for which there are many infallible proofs, abundant evidence, overwhelming evidence for the truth of the Christian faith and biblical revelation. but we have to study it to give it. So there's no excuse for laziness, neither is there any excuse for being fearful. And I'm afraid that particularly in college and in the intellectual world, the educational, scientific world, this is a real problem with many people. To be an outspoken creationist in the profession of, say, biology or geology or economics or psychology or sociology or something else means that you're going to be a real small minority and be a lot of opposition. And many people just don't want to face that. I know what I'm talking about. I've taught in universities for 30 years, public universities, and I was pretty outspoken on this, and I encountered a lot of opposition. But the Lord took care of that, and he has to this day, and he will. The Bible says God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Be not thou therefore ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, but be partaker of the affliction of the gospel according to the power of God. So there's no reason either for laziness or for cowardice in the Christian faith, and therefore the excuse that most people have for being evolutionists is not valid. Well, I know this has been maybe a little hard on some folks, but I hope you think about it at least. We don't need to be intimidated or afraid. The Bible will stand, the Christian faith will stand in its simplest, most direct, natural form, and God will bless. And I trust that you will be advised and admonished thereby. Well, thank you, and the Lord bless you. Now we're going to have a time for questions. Good question. Just where do we fit the dinosaurs into the biblical record and all the other great events of the past? Recall earlier that I emphasized Exodus 20:11, which is in the Ten Commandments, says in 6 days, literal days, God made heaven and earth and the sea and everything that's in them. That would have to include dinosaurs. So I believe that God created the dinosaurs along with the other animals on the 5th and 6th days of creation. That's when he created the animals. Now, we get a clue to that, as a matter of fact, in the Bible. It says in Genesis 1:21, where it's talking about that, first act of creation of animal life, it says God created great whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly, and so on. Well, the interesting thing there is that the word for whales is not the Hebrew word for whales. It's the word that's sometimes translated sea monsters. It's the word tanin. And in other parts of the Bible, that's translated dragons. So what it really says is God created great dragons. Now, most people don't like to, most Christians, they're a little bit embarrassed about that. They don't want those people out there to know that the Bible talks about dragons and unicorns and things like that. But the fact is it does. And there are a lot of references to dragons in the Bible. Not only in the Bible, but in all the traditions of all the nations around the earth. Where did everybody get this notion about dragons? Unless, way back in the beginning of human history, they had some experience with these great reptilian monsters, and as they became extinct, then the tradition maybe got stretched a little bit, and they became dragons. But I don't think there's anything too unreasonable about the idea that man and the dinosaur lived at the same time. Well, you ought to know that. You read Alley-Oop and Flintstones. And then besides that, we've got some other evidence, too. There are places where human bones have been found in the Dakota Sandstone, which is the same as the formation that has the Dinosaur National Monument in it. There are places where human footprints and dinosaur footprints have been found in the same formation. There are several places around the world where early tribes made pictographs of dinosaurs that have been found. So apparently early people knew about dinosaurs. And the Bible mentions it. Have you ever read the description of Behemoth and Leviathan in Job? Let me read that. I don't want to belabor this, but this is interesting, I think. You know the story of Job, how Job and his three friends were arguing about life and its meaning, and they were arguing back and forth, and they were really getting anywhere because they were arguing down on the human level. And finally, God came down and said, in effect, the thing that's wrong with you men is that you need to look at God's creation, see things as they really are. And so he talks about the great things he'd created, beginning at Job chapter 38. But then in chapter 40, he comes to the greatest animals he had made, and he talks about Behemoth and Leviathan. Now look what he says about Behemoth in Job chapter 40, verse 15. And when you read about Behemoth, the commentators have a time with behemoths. Some of them say he's a hippopotamus. Schofield here says he's an elephant. But when you read the description, it's not talking about elephants and hippopotamuses. Think about Brontosaurus, a great dinosaur that had the long little neck, you know, the long neck and the little head, and then the great big hind section, big tail and back legs and all. And you see pictures of him out in the swamp drinking up the water, eating up the grass and so on. Well, think about that when you read about Behemoth here. God says to Job, "Behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo, now his strength is in his loins, and his force in the navel of his belly. He moveth his tail like a cedar." You ever see an elephant's tail? "His bones are as strong pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He's the chief of the ways of God, the greatest animal God ever made. He that made him can make his sword to approach him," and so on. You read that description, it's a perfect description of a great dinosaur, a land dinosaur, and I think Leviathan is a marine dinosaur. Well, no, I don't think any serious problem in believing that all the different fossils found in the great record of the rocks lived at the same time, and were all buried essentially at the same time during the Great Flood. We'll talk about that more tomorrow night. Yes. Was whether the ark could have held all the animals, including the dinosaurs and the other extinct animals. Yes, you can make the calculation. The dimensions of the ark are given in Genesis 6 in terms of cubits, but you can work it out, and without going into the details, it's all in one of my books, the Genesis Flood, I think maybe in some others too. You can show that in terms of the known living animals, land animals, plus allowing for an equal number of extinct land animals, and this is not all the imaginary transitional animals that never existed, but the ones that have really been documented as fossils. All of these, you could have had two of every species of land animal living or extinct, including dinosaurs. Well, they're probably baby dinosaurs. And about half of the size of the ark. The reason I say babies, because all the animals probably were young animals, because they had to survive for a year in the ark and then go out and repopulate the world, so they're probably all young animals. But even if they were big, full-grown dinosaurs, there was room enough in the ark for them. Yeah. There are about 20,000 known species of land animals, and by that I mean birds, reptiles, mammals, amphibians. Doesn't include the insects, but they wouldn't take much room, and they could maybe even perch on the outside of the ark, for that matter, if they needed to survive that way. But all the large land animals, and of course the average size animal is not very big, probably about the size of a sheep. And if you make that assumption, then that's the way it figures out. Yes. The unicorn? Let's see, where is the unicorn? Unicorn. Oh, there's one in the 22nd Psalm, where Christ is speaking prophetically and says that he was about to be impaled on the horns of a unicorn. That's in the 22nd Psalm. Leviathan is mentioned in Psalm 104, and I think that's the same as Job here. I forget where the other references to unicorns are, but at any rate, the word, probably that has a reference primarily to the aurochs, or the great wild bull, which is now extinct. Yes. Yes, I think so. The question was, has the apparent advance in civilization and culture and technology and so on, which looks like an evolutionary progress, conditioned many people to think in terms of earlier biological evolution? I think that's probably true. But I think the answer to that is pretty obvious, that the reason the human race has been able to advance technologically and appear to grow in complexity and knowledge and size and so on is because of the very fact of man's uniqueness. Now, animals can't do that. In other words, no matter how thoroughly you train a dog to do all kinds of tricks, you got to train his puppies all over again to do the same tricks. None of the animals can accumulate information one generation and transmit it to the next. But man is different. Man is a special creation in the image of God, and therefore what one generation learns can be transmitted to the next generation. So that this apparent increase in knowledge is simply a testimony to the uniqueness of man, as created in the image of God, that he can transmit such knowledge from one generation to the next. Not an evolutionary growth at all. Yes. Well, I agree with that. Of course, in the fossil record, there's not nearly as much resemblance in the so-called evolutionary theories as there are between the different forms of automobiles. So that there's far less evidence of evolution in the fossil record than in the automobiles. Yes. Yeah, that's a real good question, and probably it's going to take a long time to answer it adequately. His question was, if man was created 4,000 B.C., what about the evidence of human fossils that are older than that? Well, as I said earlier, biblically, and we're talking mainly about the biblical aspects tonight rather than the scientific, there cannot be anything older than man. Well, they can 5 days older, maybe, but because everything was made in 6 days, according to God. But now, what about the radiocarbon method and the uranium method and so on that indicates the Earth is much older than that, and even mankind? Richard Leakey, for example, has these fossils he's been finding down in South Africa, Homo fossils, which he dates at 4 million years by potassium argon dating. What about that? Well, the problem there is that the assumptions on which these methods are based would have to be wrong. Now, that may sound arrogant to say such a thing, but really it isn't, because if you realize once again that nobody can know anything about origins because nobody was there, it's outside the scope of science, then you get it in the right perspective. You see, all this science has to do with what we can see and measure and observe, and history has to do with what earlier people have seen and observed and recorded. Once you get before the beginning of recorded history, we have no observers, and therefore no science. Scientific method involves observation and experimentation. And so nobody knows anything about the age of anything before the beginning of written history. And written records only go back about 4,000 years, depending on just how you date the first dynasty of Egypt, and there's quite a difference of opinion about that. Before 2000 B.C., everything is subject to a great deal of question. Even Dr. Renfrew at Southampton, professor of archaeology there, in his book Before Civilization, emphasizes that. The earliest dynasty of Egypt couldn't be more than about 3100 B.C., and anything before 2000 B.C. is open to serious question. So history doesn't go back before that. So then how do we know anything beyond that? You have to take some physical process, such as the decay of uranium into lead or something else, make certain assumptions about it. And with those assumptions, you can get an apparent age, but there's no way of confirming that it's a true age, because you can't test the assumptions. And if you stop and think what the assumptions are, you have to assume in any kind of a system that you're using as a time clock, uranium, lead, or whatever, you have to assume that that system is a closed system so that nothing outside can get in or inside can get out or upset the workings inside. A closed system, you have to furthermore assume that the rate at which one product is or one component is changing into the other has always been the same. And then you have to assume that you knew what the system was like when it started, what the initial boundary conditions were. Now, those are three major assumptions, none of which can possibly be valid, because in nature there isn't any such thing as a closed system in the first place. Furthermore, there's no such thing as a process rate, which is a constant rate, and that includes certainly radioactive decay rates as well as anything else. And furthermore, there's no way that we can know what the initial boundary conditions were, because nobody was there to see what they were. Now, therefore, there's no way of testing these assumptions. They're unreasonable assumptions. And oh, if I had more time, I could go into some detail on this, but the fact is that even the uranium lead and the potassium argon and these few methods that give old ages can easily be shown, if you change the assumptions a little bit, to be much more reasonable in terms of a young age. And even with the assumptions, there are scores of other processes which will give a young age for the Earth. There's much more evidence that the Earth is young, scientific evidence, than that it is old. But all of these have to be based on uniformitarianism, which is an invalid assumption in the first place, because there's no such thing as a constant, closed system in nature. Now, I like to put it this way, that since there are many processes which, with the same assumption, will give a young age, it's more reasonable that uniformitarianism is likely to be correct for a short time than for a long time, and so those processes which give a young age are more likely to be right than those that give an old age. And besides that, there are many more of them. So the weight of evidence is that the Earth is young. But the only way you can know what the age of the Earth is for somebody who was there to see and record to tell you. Well, of course, the only one who was there was God. And He has told us. In 6 days, God wrote down with his own finger on the table of stone, he made heaven and earth and the sea and everything that's in them. The trouble is people don't want to believe what God says. But all the evidence supports it. Now, this is discussed in much more depth in our books. Scientific Creationism has a chapter on the evidence for a young earth. The Genesis Flood has quite a bit of this, and some of the other books do. And I would suggest to you that if you have problems along this line, there's a great deal of good, solid scientific evidence that the earth is young, and there's no good scientific evidence that it's old. If you allow for the fact of special creation and the worldwide flood, why, all of the facts of geology and other sciences fall into place very nicely. We don't have all the answers to certain problems, but we don't have near as many problems as the evolutionist does. Yes? I think that the world is about 6,000 years old. No, I didn't say that. God says that. I keep insisting that that's what the Scripture says. And if we're talking in that frame of reference, now if a person doesn't believe the Bible, of course, that wouldn't have very much weight. But the one who does, and that's the thrust tonight, assuming that we believe the Bible, that's what the Bible teaches. And as I just said, I think all the real facts of science will support that. Yes. What does the Bible have to say about life on Mars or any place else in the universe? The Bible says nothing about life on Mars or any place else. What it does say is, in Psalm 115, it says that the heavens are the Lord's and the earth he's given to the children of men. It says in Acts 17, God has made of one blood all nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation to dwell on the face of the earth. So it looks as though God is telling us that the earth was created uniquely for man, and the earth is a unique creation. Mars isn't like the earth. Mars doesn't have liquid water, doesn't have an atmosphere, and these are necessary for life. Or if we know there's no other planet in the solar, we know there's no other planet in the solar system that has the conditions for life, and we don't know that there's any other planet in the universe, let alone one that has the conditions for life. Nobody's ever seen one. It's science is what we see. So I don't think there's any evidence that there's life anywhere in the universe except on the earth. And I do know that as far as the biblical perspective is concerned, this earth is the center of God's interest. It may not be the center of the universe. We don't know where that is. But it's the center of God's interest in the universe because this is the planet to which God himself came in the person of his son, Jesus Christ. He became man on this planet. And he died here on this planet. And he rose again on this planet. Went up into heaven from this planet. Going to come back again and live here forever. So this planet is something quite unique. It's going to be made new. It's now under the bondage of decay, and it's going to be burned up and made new again, but it's still going to be the new earth forever. And this is where God's going to live. So this seems to be uniquely designed for human life. Well, there is one other form of life out in outer space. That's angels. But nothing else, as far as the Bible indicates, and there's nothing that science indicates either. Yes. Okay, the question is, what about the... In fact, the Bible talks about light on the first day, but the sun and the moon on the fourth day. So how could there be light before the sun? Well, there are a lot of sources of light besides the sun, of course, even in the earth. And God is light, so he isn't limited to the sun. I don't know exactly, but it satisfies me to think of it this way. God, on the fourth day, it says he made the great lights, the sun and the moon and the stars, on the fourth day. Now, sometimes people say, well, how can they be billions of light years away if they were just made a few thousand years ago and we can already see them? Well, the thing is, God can create light energy as well as light generators to generate light energy. In fact, it would be easier, if anything, to generate light waves. It would be easier to do that than to generate light to create light generators to generate light waves. So it seems to me like it's perfectly reasonable at the very instant that the sun and the moon and the stars were created, their light was also created so they could be seen on the earth. That was their purpose, to be seen on the earth. To be for signs and seasons and days and years and so on. And I think it's perfectly reasonable also to say that he created light 3 days before he created the light generators to generate the light waves in the future. So that the light that he made on the first day, and this was a real day because it's defined there, by the way. If you want to know what the word day means in Genesis, he defined it the first time he used it. God says, separated the light from the darkness, and the darkness he called night, and the light he called day, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So the light was defined, or the day was defined as the light in the cyclical succession of light and darkness. So somehow the earth was rotating on its axis, and there was a succession of light and darkness. and it's been that way ever since. So light was coming from different parts of space, and then I guess the Lord decided, well, he quit generating these light waves continually. He'd just make light generators out there at the end of them to keep on generating them from then on. Now, if you don't like that, well, at least you can't disprove it. Yes. The question is, what are we doing in terms of trying to produce textbooks? That's one of our purposes, is to produce textbooks for all grades and all subjects, to teach the facts of science in either a creationist perspective for Christian schools or in a neutral perspective for public schools. As it is now, all textbooks are oriented completely around evolution. And we think that's scientifically bad science, as well as contrary to civil rights and academic freedom and everything else. So you ought to present both if you're going to have one in a public school. So that's what we're trying to do, but we've got a long way to go. We do have a biology textbook. We have a history textbook now. We have a unit study book for an introduction to a subject of origins for public schools called Creation Evolution 2 Models. That's just been published. This is probably for about the ninth grade, I suppose. We have an earth science book in process of being written. It isn't finished yet. And others plan, but we've got a long way to go. That's one of our purposes, to try to produce such books. There's a big need, and if any of you feel called to do such a sort of a work, there's a real need for that sort of thing. Yes. He's talking about the situation in the state of California. Several years ago, the State Board of Education did issue a directive that creation and evolution should both be taught in the public schools. And, of course, Max Rafferty at one time was state superintendent of education. Unfortunately, he is not now. Ronald Reagan was governor of California, and he was very sympathetic with this, but unfortunately, he isn't governor now. And John Ford is, right, he's still on the board. He's still on the board. But the creationists, at that time, the creationists were in a majority on the board. They're now in a minority. And even when they were in the majority, they never could get the full majority there at any one time and to vote for it. So, right. There was an awful lot of opposition brought to bear against it by the even such an organization as National Academy of Sciences. But it has done a great deal of good in the sense that there are many, many teachers now in the state of California that are teaching creation as well as evolution in the schools because they know that they're legally allowed to do so. And we've been getting them information so they know how to do so. So many of them are doing it, and this is being done in other states across the country, too. Of course, the Curriculum Commission has been dominated by evolutionists, but just recently there have been some creationists appointed on it. So we hope that they'll be able to do some good. But this, of course, is not just in California. The same sort of thing happens in all the states. Many of the states are seriously considering it. Some states have passed a resolution now, legislatures, endorsing the teaching of creation. That's what we recommend, not that it be compulsory. We don't think it's good to try to get a law passed requiring creation. But at least let them know that it's encouraged. And that's what we're suggesting. And then try to make information available so they'll know how to. And hopefully we'll finally want to. Right. Yes. Theistic evolutionist all through college, the thing that happened to change my views was that after getting out of college, I started reading the Bible again and also started looking seriously at this question, particularly after I went back to start teaching in college and trying to have an effective witness for Christ on the campus. I found that there were a lot of questions about this that I wasn't able to answer, so I began a serious study then. And the more I studied it, although I had some problems, I didn't know whether to continue believing in evolution or not for a while there. It wasn't long before it became obvious to me as an engineer. Engineers, you know, have to have facts. They can't guess whether the girder is big enough or not. So I was accustomed to thinking that way. And I think this is generally true, that engineers and physical scientists tend to be more likely to be able to become creationists than those in the social sciences, for example. And that was my experience in work. So both the combination of reading the Bible and finding that evolution couldn't possibly be squared with the Bible, as I once thought, and then also showing that the facts of science didn't support it either. So I've been promoting the idea ever since. Yes, ma'am. Your question is about God reigning on the earth. The Bible does indicate that there will be a new earth. This is mentioned in Revelation 22 and also 2 Peter 3, Isaiah 65 and 6. It's going to be a new earth, but it's really going to be the earth made new. The earth, that's this planet. It's not heaven. The earth. There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth, it says. But it's the present heaven and earth made new. That is, the present atmosphere made new. And it's going to be made back like God had it in the beginning. It was perfect in the beginning. And God doesn't fail in his purposes, so he's going to restore all things, renew all things. The Bible says that many places. So it's going to have the effects of sin and the curse all burned out of it. That's the reason why there's going to be, as it says in 2 Peter 3:10, a time when the elements will melt with fervent heat, and the earth also and the works therein will be burned up. But then we look, according to his promise, it says, look for new heavens and a new earth in which will dwell righteousness. And then it does indicate that Jesus Christ will reign on the earth forever. That's in Revelation 22, but it's also alluded to in a number of other passages. And so we thank you very much.